In these times of turmoil and tumult, I have often found myself wondering, does anyone really need new songs right now? Like, in the face of so much uncertainty and chaos, for those of us who are dedicated to writing and playing music, it can feel frivolous or tone deaf, even when it's in tune. What we need is leadership, resources, a real commitment to peace, stability, and strategy. So how much good is a new bop, a fresh melody, a heartfelt lyric? Does anyone really need a song? When I do allow myself to go down that rabbit hole, before I lose all hope, I think of the people in my life who have insistently reminded us that songs are so important, that they matter, and that they are needed. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. In the early days of the pandemic, when the world had gone quiet and hospital rooms were closing to visitors, Emily Kavanaugh started asking a simple question. Is there any chance anyone needs a song? At the time, Emily was like a lot of musicians in New York, suddenly without work, without venues, without a clear sense of what came next. But unlike for so many people, her instinct wasn't to look inward, it was to look outward. She started calling hospitals and hospices and offering to send a song. At first, they didn't know what to do with her. They needed doctors, they needed masks, they didn't need a song. But after a few months, the calls started coming back. A patient in isolation, a family that couldn't be there, a nurse who had seen too much. Could you send a song, they asked. What started as a handful of recordings that Emily made turned into something much bigger. She began writing songs based on the stories of patients. Over the next year and a half, she and a growing community of musicians sent close to 175 songs, many of them written from scratch. It became an organization called Song for You, a nonprofit, a network of artists, a way of preserving memory. Emily and I became friends when I produced her first record called Keep It With Mine, and we've stayed close ever since. It wasn't so long ago, but then again,
we are young.
We were young.
Roll us away again, as far as the eye can see. Wild our hearts have been, and so they're gonna be.
Eventually, we made a second project together, too. But even when we started working together, I'm not sure she fully believed that those songs belonged to her. And then slowly, something shifted. There was a moment, she describes it as a kind of realization, that if she was going to stay in New York, really stay, then music couldn't be the thing she did on the side. It had to be the center of her life. What's striking to me about Emily is that she doesn't fit the mold of the kind of person you'd expect to be building a nonprofit organization. She's disarming, a little chaotic, self-effacing. And yet she's the one who managed to organize dozens of musicians, partner with hospitals across the country, and create a system that delivers deeply personal songs to people at the most vulnerable moments of their lives. There's a tension in that. And I think that's really what this conversation is about, because at a certain point, the question isn't just, can music help people? It's, what happens when you realize that you are meant to do something? We talked not long ago. It was the day after her annual Song for You fundraiser, which was held at the Bitter End in New York. And she told me the story of how she accidentally became famous in Ireland, how she started a nonprofit, lost the use of her legs and had to relearn how to walk, ran away from the altar and towards her own destiny, why she's never felt lonely or lost, and what it means to spend a career at the intersection of songs and service. Visit EmilyKavanaughMusic.com to check out all of her various projects. Third-Story.com is the place to visit this project's archive. It's hundreds of deep dives like this one, including past episodes with mutual friends of ours like Jesse Harris and Richard Julian, both of whom have contributed to Song for You, and a remembrance of our friend, the late bass player Tim Lunsell. Visit my Substack, leosidran.substack.com, for the latest writings, musings, and newsings. And remember that we are made in partnership with WBGO. Visit wbgo.org/studios for more of their award-winning content. Just a quick note, got some upcoming shows in New York. I'll be at Barbès in Brooklyn on April 30th. I'll be joining the Slim Kings at City Winery on May 17th. I'll be joining my friend Michael Hurst at Joe's Pub on May 28th, and I'll be playing with my dad, Ben Sidran, at Mesro on June 5th and 6th. Come hang and say hello. Here's me and Emily Kavanaugh talking it down.
Okay, two questions for you before
Tell me.
We start.
Okay.
What's off limits?
I mean, I love that I'm supposed to be interviewing you and you're starting by asking what's off limits.
Yeah.
Which says a lot about who you are.
It does.
Emily
it does.
Kavanaugh.
And I'll tell you, nothing's off limits for me other than my age.
Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
We can't say your age.
No. In anything that I've been interviewed for in the last 6 years, I've never said my age.
Why won't you say your age? Is there a part of you that feels like you...
Well, wait, are we rolling?
We're always rolling.
You know, Leo, I just like to feel like, you know, I'm a bit of an old soul. So I like it to kind of be a little bit of a mystery.
You're an old soul, but have a kind of a childish whimsy about you also.
That's fair.
It's interesting that you don't want to say how old you are because you say you have an old soul, when I think there is something about you that is, and I don't mean this disparagingly at all, questionably adulting.
Are you kind of referring to the fact that I still can't really boil a hard-boiled egg?
Yeah, I'm not that kind of vibe, exactly. I think if we were to dig deep into just like your basic living situations and
way of being in the world.
Yeah, but let's get there because you're also extraordinary and impressive and amazing. And that's why I think you are an enigma. So let's talk about it. First of all, this is one of those interviews that I have to acknowledge at the beginning. It comes with its own challenges because we know each other.
Yeah, so I was kind of thinking about that actually on the bus ride over. I mean, I feel like you know all my secrets. I'm also a total fangirl of this podcast. Like, I'm waiting for the merch to drop for Christmas.
God, I should do merch.
You know? So a little bit, like, I don't know how that reads to your audience, but, like, I could quote different episodes.
So the combination of you knowing the podcast so well, being my biggest fan, having written probably, like, half of the reviews on the Apple app, and then also we've just been friends for a long time. We've worked together. You know, it's dangerous to interview somebody when you know all the answers to the questions. But the good news is I actually don't know all the answers to the questions because you kind of get to a place with people where you are so comfortable with them that you don't feel like you can just ask the most basic questions.
Yeah, there's almost like a shorthand and you feel like, well, going back would suggest otherwise or something.
Suggest that we don't really know each other or we're not really friends. So I will just briefly acknowledge, and maybe we'll get back to it, that we met through our mutual friend, Jeremy Zamuda, many years ago.
Yeah.
He suggested that I produce this record for you. And so we really got to be friends making your, is that your first full
record? Well, that's my first full record. And I'm so thankful to Jeremy. I mean, because first of all, he's the kindest person I know. But also because he brought you into my life and he brought joy into my life so many amazing people as a result of him.
You know, making a record, it doesn't always work this way, but especially in the way we made it, you know, you end up becoming friends.
Yeah.
And so we made this lovely record. And at the time, I have to say, I wasn't sure who you were entirely. You sort of downplayed your songwriting in a way. Like, these were just some songs that you had been playing in your bedroom. I'd seen some videos of you playing piano and this very direct, pure approach to singing and a very also direct and honest way of writing songs, I think.
Mm.
Evocative. When I go back and listen to that record now, I think I told you last year I listened to it and I was surprised by how moved I was by those songs.
Yeah.
That they are actually very heartfelt, soulful songs, more than I think I even understood at the time.
Well, you brought them to life. Those songs opened a lot of doors. I started touring in Ireland as a result of that record. We had a song on a Woody Harrelson trailer as a result of that record. To this day, my mom tells the story that we had a song in a Woody Allen movie. She likes to make my life even more glam than it actually is. So,
okay, so let's go all the way back, though.
Okay.
Raised in a big Irish Catholic family in Chicago.
57 first cousins. Everybody piles into a pizza parlor at Christmas because there's not a house big enough. Yeah.
Your parents?
Mom is one of seven. My dad is one of eight. My mom is a special ed teacher. So she worked on the South Side with severe and profound, you know, kiddos that were born addicted to things, all sorts of disabilities. My sister's gone on to do that work. My dad is in healthcare, sells insurance. I think like a very typical Southside Irish family in Chicago, everybody's a fireman or a nurse or a teacher and live very close to each other. Let's say of 57, probably 47 are still there. We're still all great friends. Like we were almost raised more like brothers and sisters than we were like cousins.
Is it the kind of thing where when you're in high school and starting to like date, you have to make sure that you're not possibly related to a person?
Yeah. Well, and on the South Side, it's such a common story. So as I get older and I meet more people out here, when I say 57, they're like, that's unheard of. But back home, we were actually a smaller family. There'd be like families with 75, 100. And I think music was such a big part of that from an early age, like not from any kind of formal way, but from my grandma was a great singer. So I remember like being really young and hearing early recordings of her sing. And to this day, I swear that I thought she was Judy Garland. Mm-hmm. Like, she literally had such that quality to her voice mm-hmm. that I was almost surprised when I watched Wizard of Oz and she wasn't in it. She just sort of had that quality.
And American Songbook songs?
Mm-hmm. A lot of that. So while I don't really have a show tunes background, and that would never be something that I think I would be talented enough to be a part of, that influence was definitely there early on, because that's a lot of what I heard her sing, you know.
And you sang with her.
I sang with her, yeah.
Did you perform? Did you have a performing life?
I mean, I was itty bitty, but I sang in church. Yeah. You know, I was 7, I was 8, I was 9. You know, I always would win the talent shows, though I don't know what that's really saying. I'm not sure the bar was set super high.
I think it just says that you were interested in being on stage.
Yeah, I loved to be on stage. Yeah. It's a funny dichotomy because I am the oldest of 4. Mm. So I definitely, like, I think I'm equally as comfortable, like, listening to someone else tell a story as I am to telling my own. So as much as I'm much more of an extrovert than anything else, like, I do love to sit back and absorb what somebody else is.
Yeah. Know. But you also, I mean, hearing you talk about how your mom worked with special needs kids, mm-hmm. your sister, there was an aspect of you from early on that understood that that was a thing that maybe you would do, help people go into social work or go into some kind of a way to help people.
Yeah. I knew I wanted to sing. I knew I wanted to help. I knew I wanted to come to New York. I have no idea when those little seeds were sown, but I just remember from a very early age being obsessed with New York City.
Yeah.
When I was that young, my parents were like, there's not a chance that city would eat you alive, despite that Chicago is like the murder capital of the world. But in fairness, you know, they just wanted to protect their little girl. So I ended up going to a performing arts school in the Midwest called Webster in St. Louis.
Really?
And that's where that's where it all kicked off, and studied with this amazing singer, Debbie Lennon, who told me if I ever tried to sing anything other than my own songs, I probably wouldn't have much of a career, which was a very, like, practical at the time, hard to hear, but great advice, you know.
It's really not common advice to get
No.
I mean, generally, I would think that, especially in a performing arts school, music school, they would say, if you want to have a career, you need to learn how to sing other people's songs.
I think the thought was, okay, this girl's not great with languages. She's not amazing at the theory. Like, the classical stuff doesn't seem to be sticking.
Yeah.
The jazz was just sort of in me naturally. Yeah. I would never call myself a jazz singer, but I had a lot of that ear and that sensibility, so I could do that a little easier. But I think she just thought songwriting seems to be where your heart is.
And you were writing songs in college. You were already writing.
Well, so it's funny. I was always writing and I was always singing. I never thought to pair them until I got a little bit older. I was probably like 23, 24 when I wrote my first song. So it was more like sketches of songs, you know, back then.
And always on piano sometimes?
And always on piano. Yeah. You know, the problem with dating only musicians in your 20s and your 30s is you never quite master the guitar when they're all guitar players.
So were you dating musicians in undergrad also?
That seemed to have been the case until about 5 years ago.
It was all musicians, everybody you ever.
Yeah.
So you related to, you understood how to deal with them. They were into you.
Yeah.
It just was a
thing. I was on the road before I was on the road.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, I was just like sort of like the girlfriend, always at the show, always backstage, always, you know, we have a lot of friends in common.
Yep.
I mean, I would be with Timmy at the Roseanne Cash shows or Jimmy, he was dear friends with Pearl Jam. That was our third date, you know. I mean, it was things like that that I was very young and very impressionable. And while I was always singing, I had never known you could make a career of it, right?
Because
my gran was amazing, but she also went on to have 7 kids and 35 grandkids and, you know.
I mean, that's very interesting. That thing of being the girlfriend to all these musicians and not considering that you might be one too, or be able to make a career of it. And that speaks to exactly how I felt when I met you.
Yeah.
Not that I felt that you weren't serious, but that there was something, whether or not it was externally being placed on you by the musicians around you, or whether maybe some of it was coming from you also, almost a little bit apologizing for yourself.
Oh, totally. I would be at my own shows selling my boyfriend's records. There's something both beautiful and tricky about it, because in a way, one of my favorite things about living in New York is that I love that I'm never the smartest or the most talented person in any room. Mm. Like, I love that my friends, you included, are people I look up to and people I admire. I also think sometimes then what can happen, again, that's just the oldest child, right? I'm such a disappointment to oldest children everywhere in most ways, but some of the traits I have pretty strong. And that's one of them where it's like, I'm a sponge. I have a deep well of sort of, I don't know if you'd call it empathy, it's such a buzzword, but I really feel other people in the room. Mm. So I think I was also always very aware of like, well, this person's so much more talented. So in a way, it would make me feel like, well, let's talk about you, you know?
Yes, you're good at that question. What I'm hearing you imply is that, which I think is true, is like the oldest children are the overachievers, the ones that get the good grades, the one that are the most responsible because they're the first to come along. The parents put all the expectation on the older
yeah.
kids. Is that what you think older children are
I think
normally
like,
doing?
So you know how they say like normally like an oldest child is like a type A?
Yeah.
You've known me a long time. Yeah. I would describe myself as like a B minus.
I see.
Like maybe a B plus on a good day. Now, when we had a show like we had last week, A full on, you know, comes out. But it's maybe three times a year that I go that hard. So I would say more so like the best way I can describe it is I was home this summer with my family and I'm talking to my brothers and sisters. And I said, you know, like when you're younger and, you know, you want to like stay at that party, like you're out with all your friends. And my friends were always like a lot older than me and a lot cooler than me and whatever. I'm like, you know, like you just want to kind of like stay, but you're like, oh, well, you know, mom's had like a hard day. Like I should really get home because I know she's stressed. And I'm looking at my sister and she's like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
I do not know that.
And then I said to my brother, I was like, well, you know, like when you're kind of like, you like know what you want to do. Like I wanted to go to New York so young, but you're like, well, you know what? I know dad really wants me closer to home, you know? So like, that would be a lot to like, and he just looks at me and he's like, yeah, man, I got nothing.
I've never factored our dad into my choices. Right.
And so I think in some ways it's almost like when you're the oldest, at least when you're the oldest of a big family,
yeah.
It's almost like your parents in a way are like your, my mom would hate if I said my friend, you know, because obviously she was a very clear example of, you know, a grown up. But they were almost sort of my siblings too.
Sure.
You know,
how old were they when you were born?
So my mom and I are almost 30 years apart. So yeah. At that time, that wasn't super young for that generation,
yeah.
You know, but I think we just sort of, we have been pals since like out the gate.
When you're the oldest, the thing that you have in common,
yeah.
Oldest of a big family that you have in common with your parents is that you saw the birth of every other child
totally.
After you, same as them.
Totally.
The only one that you didn't see is your own.
100%. Yeah.
So you have that in common.
Yeah.
Unlike any of your siblings, none of them share that with you.
Yeah, no, well said. And that's actually partly why when people are like, oh, it's, you know, got to be crazy. Like you come from this 800 people, you don't have any kids of your own. And it's like, I feel like I've mothered so many things.
Yes.
And so many people. And so, I mean, that would be great if that's in the cards someday. But I was definitely kind of like the second mom. But to be fair, I don't want to paint myself to be like too virtuous here. I was also pretty wild,
yeah.
You know, and always have been a total free spirit and kind of marched to my own drummer, did what I wanted to do. Have lived in New York City for 20 years. I'm still so close to my family. Like
yeah.
My siblings are my best buds.
I relate to that in you that you have lived in New York the same amount of time as I have.
Yeah.
Would you move in 2005?
Yeah, we're both on 2 decades.
Yeah. Congratulations.
You too.
But you go back to Chicago a lot.
A lot.
That's a big part of your community mm-hmm. and your sense of self. I feel that way about Madison also.
Yeah.
I'm over the idea that I'm somehow a Midwestern expatriate. I used to say I'm an
yeah.
expat. I think my life is here. My adult life has actually happened here.
Do you ever have like fantasies of going back?
Of course.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
Of course I do. I think at this moment in my life, I feel that it serves me more from a distance than it would to live there.
Okay.
But I feel enormous pride for where I came from,
yeah.
for that being a part of who I am.
Yeah.
I also think even in New York, so much of my network, my access, my point of view, I could easily draw a line from this conversation to Madison.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think that's a lot of things in my life. If you look at the root of them, they still are born in Madison.
Do you ever feel like it's almost like you grew up once there and then you grew up again in New York? Like I sometimes feel like I had like two growing ups.
So you finished undergrad and then you came here for grad school?
So I finished undergrad yeah. and then I went back to Chicago for yeah. a year to play in a piano bar called Fly Me to the Moon.
Okay.
Which is now known as Wrigleyville Wieners.
Oh, wow.
And my job was just to sing and to entertain.
Did you play piano?
Well, badly, but yeah.
Was there an accompanist? Or
no,
was it just you?
We couldn't afford the accompanist.
It was just me.
So just imagine a lot of pedal.
All for a year.
A lot of pedal. And an owner named Gregory, who, if Gregory's listening, is such a gem. But also, I think, took my tips many, many a time. Uh-huh. But would give me, you know, whiskeys and sodas. And I will tell you one funny story. My grandma,
what was her name?
Ginny, Virginia Lawler. She just had the most beautiful, she was one of the best voices I've ever heard. But she came in one night to see me sing, and Gregory had been hearing about her for years, right? And he's got this big, thick Greek accent, and, oh, grandma, you know, come sit. And he sits her down at this table, and at some point, my grandma had been pretty overserved, but we invite her up to sing with me. So she sits down next to me. She calls out a song. I don't know it. Neither does she, clearly. She starts to sing it. It's awful. Thankfully, there's only one table there, and they were really generous, very kind, and applauded. Yeah. And at the end of the night, Gregory comes up and he goes, so grandma was professional?
Because you talked about her so much. Yeah.
I talked her up for so long. My mom loves that quote to this day. So yes, so I sang in a piano bar. I waited tables. I saved enough money to come to New York. I mean, what's ever enough money for New York?
Yeah.
But you know, I live in a cupboard for $900. So it was. I know, it's a total mystery. And this is like the 13th apartment in 20 years or something. Do you know all my apartments? Do we want to get into that? Is that too far?
I do want to get into some of that. So
you're like, just not now.
We're going to get there right now.
Okay.
So you, piano bar, you save enough money. You moved to New York.
Came to New York. Got into NYU. Started in the music therapy program.
Yes.
Amazing department. That's how I know Nir. So now, to this day, my music director and very dear friend and co-writer in a lot of songs.
Nir Sedovnik.
Was actually my professor at NYU.
So this is this turning point where you also say, I love music and I'm also going to do it as a form of service.
Yes, true. Although I realized shortly into the program that might not be the route for me.
Yeah.
I just sort of felt like maybe it was just the internship I had, or it was the way in which I was set up with it. But I basically was sent around a lot with like the face painters and the clowns, like singing Kumbaya in the corner, and it didn't really gel.
You know, music therapy is a very mysterious thing.
Oh, I have total respect for it.
I do too. Yeah. I did an episode years ago called What is Music Therapy?
I feel like I remember that one.
I interviewed three music therapists. Anyway, you realized that maybe music therapy wasn't the right fit.
But I loved the program.
Yeah.
And so, because I knew I was going to make so much money, obviously, in what I've pursued with my life, I figured, let's just get a couple more college credits. So I ended up getting my master's in social work at NYU.
I see.
With an emphasis in music therapy.
Uh-huh.
So because I have a lot of respect for that field, I'm always careful to say I do a lot of therapy in the music that I do, but I'm not a music therapist.
In the end, ultimately, though, you ended up using music as a tool of healing and support.
Yeah, ironically, that is kind of what I became.
That is what you became in your own way.
Yeah.
Kind of independent of the conventions of music therapy, you found a way to use music therapeutically. So now you're here.
But like Nir's a proper music therapist. I always want to give like deference. You know what I mean?
Totally.
Frank is a proper music therapist. I'm just sort of a girl that hangs with them who uses music as a way to hopefully bring a little bit of healing.
One of my limits with music therapy is, because I have a handful of music therapist friends also, and I recognize that when we make music, it is our job to remove judgment from the process and just allow for self-expression. But I also have like a very specific criteria and agenda when I make music.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me to just make music as a pure form of expression with no structure.
Well, I can tell you I relate in that regard in terms of like, that's probably why I was never going to be able to be a teacher.
Yeah.
Just because, well, one, no one's going to trust me with a room full of children. I just, I'm a little not so structured and organized, et cetera. But also like, I think a little bit of that earnestness that you need to be able to, it's like nails on a chalkboard if someone's singing off key, you know? There's, I do have a little bit of that.
So when you finished grad school, the idea was you're going to be a socialist, a social worker. You're going to be a social worker.
I mean, pretty much,
yeah.
The idea was I was going to be a social worker and I would always gig and sing on the side, which is essentially what I did for about 5 years.
Yeah.
And then you and I made that record.
Yeah.
Baby, let's just stay a while while the night is young and we got nowhere else to be. And maybe in a little
while the world is fast asleep. You'll be holding me so sweetly in your arms.
And obviously I can't say everything changed, but I basically, when I turned 30, I sort of had this light bulb moment. And I was like, I can be a social worker and sing on the side anywhere. Like, I'm so close to my family. I love New York, but I could do that anywhere. Mm. If I'm really going to stay here and kind of put roots down, music has to be at the forefront. And pretty much ever since I said that, it's been the case. New York on its own is just like my greatest love affair. Mm. But to justify being here, yeah, I knew that music had to be at the forefront. Yeah. And pretty much since I made that choice, it always has been.
So there's this other aspect of you which you own kind of proudly in a funny way, which is that you are a recovering runaway bride.
Oh, we're going to go there. Is this because it was in my bio the other night? By the way, can I just, as an aside, say that I had so many people compliment your performance, one, full stop, but also say that it might have been the funniest line of the night. You said, you know, Leo was introduced by the amazing Dennis Elsis, and he gave his great bio, and it's obviously very lengthy and impressive. And
start writing songs professionally as a teenager.
Leo gets on stage and he says he'd followed this beautiful gospel
choir. I like that you've
choir.
Just pivoted to the audience who's listening, no, explaining to them what Leo did.
I'm speaking to right now my mom.
Yeah.
Okay. So Leo,
yes,
says, I don't know what's harder to follow, that amazing gospel choir or my own bio.
Yes.
I really don't know what is a harder act to follow, that choir or my own biography, which is like, you get an email, send a biography, and then that happens.
What can one say about oneself that both tells the truth but also mm-hmm. keeps it a little more under control? You know, we're so used to saying all of our achievements so that you want to make sure you don't miss a single achievement. I think until you actually have achieved enough that is personally gratifying to you, that it doesn't matter what they say about you.
Right. 100%.
And that's where I'm trying to get to. Like, I don't need you to know all my credits when I walk on stage.
Right. Although Dennis wanted to share them.
Dennis is super into that. And I think the reason he does that is because the event that we're talking about was a fundraiser for your organization. Mm-hmm. And by really selling all of the artists that are up there, it's actually making a case for the organization.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I walked away like already so proud of my friends for being there and being a part and so grateful, but like even prouder, you know, when I heard all the accolades.
So he's right to do that.
Yep.
But the other thing that I said when I got on stage, which I think is actually the heart of what I wanted to say about you, I mean, it really speaks to this thing about being an old soul and also being kind of childlike in a way, is you are deceptive. I said, Emily Kavanaugh managed to get a room full of musicians to a venue early. You have this kind of exuberance and enthusiasm, and it's a little, sometimes even comes off as naive, but that's effective, and it gets things done. People want to make you happy, I think that's a big part of it.
Thank you. In
your bio, you said you're a runaway bride.
Sometimes I like there to be a little levity, too, in those events. So I also said I'm a Chicago pizza lover.
Yes.
And recovering late-night snacker. But I am. Yeah, I am a runaway bride, you know.
You were with almost exclusively with musicians until finally you were involved with somebody who was not a musician.
Who was in a totally other world.
Who was like a money guy.
Yeah. And I realized that is not a world that I belong in.
But you walked it right up to the edge. Mm-hmm. And I remember when you did that, thinking you are on a path that is like truly and entirely your own.
Yeah. I mean, I guess like, you know, I have felt so many things in New York. I think after living here long enough, right? I've been broke. I've been missing my family. I've been homesick. I've been hungover, tired, burnt out. I've never felt lonely. And I've never felt lost. And that's something that's like just, I feel so lucky to be able to say that. Like, I've always known who my friends are. I've always known who I am.
Yeah.
And so I think I was sort of swept up in the love and the fun. I also have, you know, all my family's roots are Ireland. My partner was from there. We bonded over. I was about to go on tour with a really beloved Irish musician, and I literally met him in a bar the night before. And it was just kind of this, I love a great story. And then that lasted for almost 5 years.
Yeah.
But in the end, I just knew like something in my heart, I was able to pick my bridesmaids in my dress, but I couldn't pick the date. And I think I just knew, like, this isn't right, you know? And here we are, you know, 13 boyfriends, 9 mother-in-laws later for a girl who's never been married. And I actually feel so lucky for all the love that I've had in my life. You know, like, I think a lot of people look at me and they're like, are you okay? Like, get some cats and settle down in that cupboard of yours. But I'd rather be on my own than alone in something that was never meant for me.
Something that happened to you after that experience, though, is that
I was single for the first time ever. So I went 20 years not on my own, which probably speaks a lot to some like codependency stuff there. But, you know, I was always lucky. I always had amazing boyfriends, partners, people, you know, and New York is great for that. You know, you're constantly, especially if you're out in that scene and everybody's so interesting and we're young. And
in this period when you are single and living, I don't know how you lived. I remember you told me before. I mean, you had told me that you at one point you like lived under a table or something, like under stairs or something.
Well, okay, I didn't live under the table, but I did have to sleep under it a few times. So I basically lived.
When is this that you lived under the table?
So I lived under a table after I lived in a hallway.
Yeah.
Okay. So things were moving up. But yeah, I mean, I've kind of lived the gamut. Yeah. So when I moved to New York, I lived with a girl that NYU partnered me with who ended up being like a sister to me, Gracie. And we're still like the best of friends to this day. It's been a lot of crazy. I've lived with my girlfriends. I've lived with my boyfriends. I've lived with random people. I lived with my boyfriend, Jimmy, when we were real young, with his bandmates. Yeah. And so there were 4 of us to bunk beds. And people would queue up. This is in Williamsburg. I know. I can just see it on your face. To shower every morning. I lived with a woman named Rena who thought my name was Julie. She was in her 80s. And I'd come home late at night and she'd be like, Julie, is that you? And I was like, yeah, Rena, it's me. It's Julie. Because I just didn't have the heart to tell her.
How'd you pay her?
Well, I didn't have to because I basically slept in a Murphy bed that pulled out from her wall in exchange for taking her to doctor's appointments and hearing her stories and things. I lived with an Estonian escort in Williamsburg. Very high end, of course.
Sure.
And then I lived in a hallway where my roommate had to walk through my room to get to his. But we were great friends, so it worked out well. And then I was in the, you know, the table under the stairs and all of that. But then I did have like a period of time where I went the other way and Danny DeVito was my neighbor, you know.
Danny DeVito was your neighbor. I like that that's the flex, just to give you a sense of how high I was living. Danny fucking DeVito was my neighbor. Okay, got it.
I hope that's the quote from the episode.
That's going to be the title of the episode. Danny DeVito was my neighbor.
That's when you know you've arrived, you guys. It's not a washer dryer.
But despite all that, walked it back. And you find yourself single, living cheap, trying to figure things out. And then your body starts attacking you.
Yeah.
In a mysterious way.
That's right. That's right. What's wild is that that all happened in the heart of the pandemic, you know? So I think given the fact that the world had gone dark and everything was kind of crazy, it was the one thing that kept me from maybe getting really scared was like we were all in it together. I went out for a run and I was never much of a runner. I'm not all that naturally athletic, but I have a lot of energy and I would run every morning, like snow, rain, hail, hungover, I would run. And I went for a run one day and my legs just gave out. And I came home and I thought, you know, maybe this is not, you're not doing enough squats. You're not paying enough attention to building other parts of your body. Like you're not strong enough essentially to be running every day. I thought that's all that it was. What's wild is that then that lasted for only 3 weeks that I couldn't put one foot in front of the other. But I was climbing my stairs. I was living in a 6th floor walk up at the time. And I was climbing my stairs with my hands to get to my apartment. And this was like the height of COVID. So I also had crazy plastic baggies. This was when we were wiping down our mail on my hands. And my landlord saw it in the camera. And he's like, is everything okay? You know, so my arms never looked better. But I knew that something was off. I was lucky. I had a really amazing team of doctors that looked after me. I went from running every day to not being able to walk on my own for about 9 months without the assistance of a cane that I named Caney. Mm-hmm. She became part of my act. I learned how to swim. And then from there, I learned how to walk again. But it was a wild time in an already wild time in the world.
Yeah. I mean, my memory was that there was a sense that you might not walk again.
Yeah, there was. There was. And I never went there, you know, like that's maybe where sometimes my naivete or even sometimes my willful oblivion yes. to like certain things actually works in my favor, because I never lost my optimism. You know,
no, and also you dated. You told me that you went on like 100 dates or something.
I went on like 50 first dates, okay, with a cane. And I would rock up to these dates. And I would literally, I remember one time I made this guy so red by the end of it. I said something like, "Hi, I'm going to have to put my legs in between yours for the duration of the meal. I know we've just met." Uh-huh. And he was so lovely. Like people were so lovely. Yeah, that's my memory of it. It's like everybody was amazing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was
New York really, delivered for you.
New York definitely delivered. Yeah.
That was maybe one of the most impressive things I've ever seen is the way you handled it and the resilience and the positivity in the face of it. Our mutual friend, the late Tim Lunsell, who did ultimately die, the first thing when he was just starting to get sick in a weird way that he said to me was, "I hurt my leg. Mm-hmm. I can't walk."
Yeah.
And then it devolved, and your journey kind of paralleled that.
Yeah, I'm still close to some of his friends, and I had a few of them without coming right out and saying, "Is it ALS?" Yeah. You know, sort of asking a little bit roundabout. Timmy was so amazing. You know, I think you remember he put that group together, like 100 people he would invite to a barbecue.
Yeah.
And we all sort of stayed pals, and we would send recipes and, you know, Knicks games and photos. And so there's just been such a great community as a result of him. But yeah, he was always in my mind around that time. Because to be honest, to this day, I know now what's going on, but they never did. Like as in the doctors basically wrote in my chart, potential long COVID, because they threw COVID on everything they didn't know. And or Guillain-Barré, which is what Sufjan Stevens actually ended up having.
Oh.
Although his case is so much worse. Mine was, if at all, it was just something that mimicked it almost.
I see.
You know, it's like a neurologic condition where the brain just doesn't fire to the legs.
Really? So what is the diagnosis?
So...
And if you don't want to...
No. It's okay. It's just so... What's crazy is like... Maybe this is the oldest child in me where like I sometimes feel like I got through that with like laughter and kind of great friends. And I you know, I had a partner at the time who would carry me up my stairs when I couldn't walk up them. But I think I felt like that was all behind me once I learned how to walk again and Caney was put away and, you know, take her out for special occasions. But and then it was about 2 years ago, my mom actually wasn't feeling good. She had her 70th birthday or 69th birthday. And we were out and just having a great time celebrating her. And she ended up not feeling well for about 6 months. And I remember at the time saying, "Mom, a lot of this sounds kind of similar. Maybe there's a chance like this is long COVID, you know?" And like the good daughter I am, I think just sympathy pains, I wasn't feeling well either. And so we would joke, you know, we were just kind of tracking on the same trajectory for a long time. But then hers ended up being, she was diagnosed with a pretty rare form of leukemia and a blood disorder. And so, you know, she's been dealing with that for almost 2 years now. And ironically enough, within a few months of that, the person that carried me up my stairs that, you know, is to this day one of my best pals, who was my pandemic boyfriend at the time, was diagnosed with the same thing. Hmm. And within 6 months of that, I was also diagnosed with a blood disorder. And so mine is something I was born with, and it's not... touch wood, like it's, I'm not dealing with what they're dealing with. It's not cancer, but I am seen by a team of oncologists and hematologists. I get regular infusions. You know, I have an incredible team at New York Presbyterian and Weill Cornell. So yeah, like mine is livable, but if I didn't get the treatment I'm getting, it'd be a very different situation. I think, again, it goes back to like in the pandemic when I wasn't walking, people were dying. I just wasn't walking. You know, I mean...
And did you honestly, you were able to separate your own suffering from the suffering of others and say, my suffering is not as bad as...
Oh, all the time. And the same now. Like in what I just shared it, right? It's like, I'm able to kind of see that I have it good compared to the two people that I love the most in the world who are dealing with what they're dealing with, you know? So when my mom's able to say things like, it could be worse, like, it could be better too. But, you know, she doesn't go there. And so I don't really go there either.
Before you got sick at the beginning of COVID, you're looking around thinking, what can I do?
Yeah. I mean, weren't we all like...
I don't know. I mean, I think many people were asking, what can I do for myself?
Mm. I'm sure I had that too. Yeah. I mean, I was snacking all the time. And
but so you started thinking, maybe there's something I can do musically
mm-hmm.
that will help people.
Yeah. Like essentially it was just this idea that like the venues had gone dark, the world had gone dark. At the time I was making most of my living singing and gigging. I was healthy. And so I just remember feeling like I was watching these stories of these patients that were passing away in rooms without their families. And as someone who obviously family is a huge part of my everything, my core, that was the thing that like stuck out to me. I think everybody has a memory of that time that's very personal. And then there's the more collective, but personally, that was what struck me. So I essentially, in between eating a lot and eating all my feelings and drinking and watching too much Schitt's Creek and binging Netflix with my mom.
Because you were in Chicago?
I was in Chicago for the first 3 months of it. Yeah.
So March 2020.
Yeah, I was in Chicago.
You decided I'm going to go to...
Well, actually, I had an uncle and auntie who were like, this is going to be a lot worse than you think it is. And I was like, it's going to be fine. And they're like, so pack a bag and come home. And I said,
so
okay.
So you were not alone. You're not in isolation.
No. I said, I'll come home for three weeks. And 3 weeks turned to 3 months. So I was there until the very start of July.
Gotcha.
But it was about June when I started cold calling hospices and hospitals and just saying, is there any chance anyone needs a song? And I know I've said this to you before, but obviously I think initially the first reaction was like, we need workers. Like we need PPE. We need masks. We don't need a song from this obscure songwriter in New York City, you know. But within a few months' time, everybody called back. Every chaplain, every nurse practitioner, every volunteer coordinator. We have a nurse in isolation. We have a kiddo that's not going to go home. We have this couple in hospice and they're so confused. Could you send a song? What started as just sending songs, you know, comfort songs, ways to sort of help people feel a little less alone.
Songs that exist, covers of songs.
Yeah. I Want to Hold Your Hand. Yeah. You know, I mean, like low budge, low version, low quality. Yeah. But yeah, sent these covers and then eventually realized, well, maybe like there's something to this if we write these songs.
Yeah.
Because I think what struck me was that people were dying in rooms with other people that loved them and that their story and their legacy wasn't going to be told.
Yes. So you wrote a lot of them yourself. Initially, you wrote most of them yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually you expanded to your community.
Yeah. We ended up, I think, sending close to like 175 songs in 18 months' time. And about 100 of those were written from scratch based on the stories of the patients in the room as told to their families and then told to their social workers and told us.
Were you still working as a social worker at that point?
No. So the way I sort of describe it is like, I feel like I will always have a social worker heart. And I've essentially spent a long time at the intersection of music and service. I still sing for seniors, you know, with Alzheimer's. Yep. I still sing for kiddos with cancer and I'll do that work forever. But I've only paid my rent singing for about almost 10 years now.
You know, I remember I didn't realize that for the longest time because I would see you in certain circles and then you would say to me like, yeah, I'm singing 5 nights a week or I'm singing all over the city and I've got this whole group of people and we could sing Irish songs and cover songs and this and that.
Yeah. So that was the community.
Yeah.
You're part of it.
Yeah.
You know, Timmy's friends are part of it. Yeah. My friends in Ireland are part of it. Yeah. And I think that's what was so amazing was that in such a crazy time, everybody said yes. Like, yes, I will send a song. Yes, I will write a song.
Yes.
And if they didn't, let's say they didn't feel moved to write their own, they would do a cover. Or let's say they felt that they had Sophie B. Hawkins, for instance, As I Lay Me Down to Sleep, the most beautiful song in the world. She sent her own version of her own song, but personalized it and gave a shout out to a patient. And that was his favorite song.
Yeah.
You know, so he got to hear that before he passed.
Over the years, you were able to attract some big songwriters, known artists.
Yeah, I think, you know, maybe we've got 50 artists that have written a song. I want to say 10 have either won or been nominated for a Grammy. Mm-hmm. You know, Sarah McLachlan sent a song this year, although I always give the caveat through her manager, Jane, because I feel like Jane knows a lot more about us than maybe Sarah does, but they've been so generous. You know, Keb Mo recently sent one, Leo Sidran, Jesse Harris, Richard Julian, the list kind of goes on.
I realized the other day at your annual fundraising event
that
originally it was called Emily's Initiative.
A lot of people, when they did the shout outs, would say, hey, I'm here with my friend Emily's Initiative. Because I don't think we had any idea. We didn't know where the world was going, right? I had no idea where this was going to go.
Yeah.
So I think the thought was just like, if we could send a few songs, make a few people happy.
Yeah.
I didn't know it would grow into its own charity. I didn't know we would go from writing for 150 first responders in a hospice in New York City as a way to say thank you at Christmas, that we'd go from doing that to then writing for 15,000 healthcare workers. Yeah. In a system in Idaho 2 years later. You know, like, I could never have imagined sort of what it's grown to.
Right. So here you are, basically, there must be a part of you that understands how to operate in the sort of institutional world. Nonetheless, I mean, this has become a 501c3. This has become a nonprofit organization. There's a board of directors. Is there a director?
So I've kind of worn most of the hats, but we do have wonderful volunteers. Yeah. We have the advisory board. This last year, I had an amazing person helping me named Dalton DeLon. He was just a wonderful addition. It was only a 1 year contract, but he was great, you know? So yeah, so we have a lot of help, but a lot of it does fall
on you.
Fall on me.
And how do you see it today? So now we're 5 years out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you asked me to send a song earlier this year and some of the talking points were, now we're not in pandemic anymore. Right. So now this is, the mission has to shift.
Mm-hmm.
And this is still an important and useful service to provide, even though at the moment we're not in a pandemic. We could be in another one at any moment.
Right.
And if we are, Song for You Foundation is ready and willing.
Dalton had said something great in the mission statement he crafted. And it's this idea of, like, we bring music to folks in hospice, hospital, and home, as well as the people who look after them, the first responders, with the hope of preserving their legacy, as well as bringing a little bit of gratitude, not grief, to people in trying times. And I just love that, because I think it speaks to this whole idea of these really heavy things that are happening all around us all the time,
mm-hmm.
but still finding, like, the beauty and the humor and the humanity. On a more practical level, I'd love to be able to bring in somebody to sort of run the thing. I could be its artistic director. You know, my dream for it would be to always help write these songs, always be the liaison with the artists, talk to the families, talk to the social workers, you know, but have a more business-minded person maybe at the helm, you know?
And how is it, from a songwriting standpoint, to have to dig deep and just write another song? I mean, do you hold yourself accountable in terms of, like, I don't want to repeat myself melodically, lyrically, you know?
Totally. Like, I'm such a purist to the point where, like, AI is either going to, like, take over my, right?
Yeah, that's very much on my mind.
Yeah. But funnily enough, where it's actually kind of been, it's changed my process, is I don't know that I can write songs for myself as well anymore. Like, it's almost strange to sit down and write a love song after you've written a song. You know, for instance, I wrote for a woman whose dream was to marry her partner on Valentine's Day, like, under an oak tree in California. She passed away, but before she died, we were able to write this love song for her, and they ended up dancing to that song under the tree on their, that was their song. So I say that to say that came to me, and that took 30 minutes. If I were to sit down and write my own love song, I don't know.
But maybe you don't have to. I mean, that is your own love song. Is that your own love song? Like, this is the thing. Do you copyright these songs?
If by copyright you mean, do I, like, write out that I wrote them on a certain day and, like, there's proof of it in a paper trail? Yes. I haven't registered any of them with, like, BMI or ASCAP or...
But if you were to,
mm-hmm.
would you take 100%
ridership? This is actually a great question. This is something that, like, we had a law firm that was representing us for a while, and we kept going back and forth on, like, well, when the songwriter sends the song, I want the songwriter to own the rights.
Of course.
100%, you know? But they were like, okay, well, we've got to figure that out contractually, and how is that going to work, and how, you know, so...
That's an interesting thing, because I understand that question, that your organization needs to have, let's say, non-exclusive rights in perpetuity to use it however you need to use it.
Yeah.
That's, like, a very legal way of thinking about it. What I'm saying is the song is inspired by the truth of somebody's life.
Yeah. No, it's a great question.
And that person is not the songwriter, because they didn't write the song. However, what you're saying is it's much easier to write the oak tree song because they, first of all, they gave you all the images. Mm. They gave you the desire, the motive, the shape of the story.
Yeah.
And yet it's not their song. And I don't believe that it, as a songwriter, I don't think it is their song. I think it's the writer's song.
That's funny you say that, though. I don't know if you remember, I said at the bitter end, like, so for instance, we have this song coming out. Scott Sherrard produced it.
Yeah.
It's one of the first songs I wrote in the pandemic.
Yeah.
And it's all about this idea of this young girl at the time who wrote me about her dad.
Yeah.
And how she really wanted to like capture his legacy. And even after he's gone, the idea that she'd go on singing his name, you know, and so that's actually the name of the song. So I always sort of joke before I play, I say, you know, this is a song that I wrote early days in the pandemic on behalf of Luke for Kayla. And I always say, but I actually feel like Kayla might be my co-writer.
Well, she might be. I mean, it's possible that case by case, if she gave you I'll Keep Singing Your Name, maybe that she is a co-writer.
So I will stand beside you if it comes in the night. For you I'd walk forever in the rain. And when
but it's an interesting thing. And then you get into the AI of it. And it's like, you know, you talk about the humanity, which is true. Not only the AI of it, but, you know, there's another organization I get served these ads where people pay to have a song written and produced for a loved one or whatever. Mm. And it's just a service.
Okay.
It's like you would probably do some kind of interview or some intake thing and say, I want a song in this style.
Yeah.
Sung by a male singer or a female singer. Here's a bunch of songs that I like.
Yeah.
And here's the story of a couplehood or whatever. And then you pay to have this song and people are giving them as gifts. And I think about that organization relative to your organization. And I think even if the outcome is the same, it's actually the intent that's different.
Right.
And intent is a powerful thing.
Totally.
And it totally changes.
Totally. So what's is money, going on. Which we don't have any of.
Well, that's what they have going that you don't have is they're doing it for money.
But no, it's a great question. And I sort of always say to people, like, we're not all that unique in that there's so many personalized songwriting companies out there, many of which popped up, by the way, in the pandemic, right? I think sort of our, what separates us out is that our story, like we were born in a time when the world had gone dark, the venues had gone dark, right? And this was like a small way to bring hope to people in what seemed like hopeless times, you know? Now, I don't know how long that story will carry us. Like the press has been so generous. It's been covered by lots of people. I'm here sitting with you today talking on my favorite podcast. It's really sort of like taken on a life of its own, bigger than I would have imagined. But for it to continue, the sustainability factor, yes, we need to like distinguish ourselves from these places. We probably do need to have like a true business person running it. And I think also like we need to find a way to carve out our niche where we can still keep our mission of keeping songs free to families, but be able to pay our artists. Because that's the one thing I don't want to get to a place where we're an arts nonprofit that doesn't pay its artists. That doesn't feel right.
I mean,
to
is
me.
There a way to make a song, assign it a monetary charitable amount, and do you say to an artist, you can claim this song as a charitable donation?
Oh, Leo, maybe you should be on the board.
We value a song at $5,000.
Yeah.
You can claim, I don't know. I don't know anything about charitable donations, but rather than paying them, maybe it becomes a charitable donation.
That's great.
In kind.
I mean, and everybody the other night too that came out to play, you know, that was such an all-star lineup and everyone was like, I can't take money from you. You actually were like, you didn't give me money.
I was like, I can't take it because you didn't give it.
But everybody else.
I would take it if you would give it. I think there have been very few moments in my life when I feel like I knew what I was supposed to do and I knew that I was in the right place doing it. And I know that you're a social person and you're outgoing and that you've never felt alone or lost. But I also see you as on such a singular and personal path that I've been very moved by and sort of astounded by seeing your board get on stage and your advisory board and all these people who are doing this because they believe in the project, yes, but in you. I mean, I think the idea is bigger than you, but it's also very tied to you. And I just wonder if there was a moment for you when you just realize, like, this is what I'm supposed to do.
I think when my mom got sick, it solidified it.
Yeah.
I think a lot more about, you know, there's a line in the song that Kayla, I'll say that Kayla helped me write, where it says, it's true, I've never been much good at goodbyes. don't want a party to end, would rather dance a night than wake when the light had left me feeling rested. And then it's true, I never thought so much about time, too busy to slow me down, but now it's looking all of us in the eye, never moved much faster than now. And I have to say, like, at the time when I wrote it, it just felt like it spoke to the story of the person I was writing it for. But when I played it the other night at the Bitter End, it spoke a lot more to me.
I think that song sounds very much like an Emily Cavanagh song. And
Pang.
And it made me think about the songs that you had written before. Mm. Like, I mean, I referenced that song, We Were Young, before, which I always thought of as just kind of like a maybe coming of age song.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of songs about the night. You know, in the first collection of songs, it was a lot of songs.
You liked Dark Was the Night. That's the one we did
together. I love Dark Was the Night. Yeah, of course. Which was also sort of a mission-driven song initially. That was
true,
one of your
for
first,
Rwanda. Yeah.
One of your first songs about something bigger than...
Yeah. Yeah.
And hearing somebody else's story also, right?
True.
What was the story of that song?
That is written in on behalf of this amazing woman, Kansole Nishimwe, who's a survivor of the Rwandan genocide. And so her story was just so compelling to me. And this was actually when I was still a social worker, you know, working pretty full time. And my job was to help her write her story. And she ended up publishing a book, and I made that record with you at the same time. Yeah. And so we put that on as like the very last song on the record.
Yeah.
And she shared it with the consulate, and we ended up performing quite a few times at the UN with her song and me singing and then her telling her story.
I wanted to fly so far from all of this pain. I wanted to run faster than wheels on trains. But dark was the night, all of the lights went out again. So dark was the night till I learned to sing.
So maybe that was an early example of how telling people's stories through songs.
I guess I hadn't thought of that.
Could be a
you
thing.
Know? But this idea of getting to a place in your life where you feel like, I don't know, I feel like when the pandemic hit, it was sort of this feeling of like a lot of the grown-ups left the room. The change in administration, the scary person that ended up taking over. Personally, like, you know, I had a lot of amazing doctors, but they didn't know what was going on with me. You know, my own mom getting sick. Like, I think I sort of, you talk about adulting, I was forced to confront my mortality in a way that, in an interesting way, I've been doing my whole life because I've had a lot of loss from a very early age, but it hit me differently. And it hit me differently the other night at the Bitter End when I played that.
I mean, I do think you realize you reach a certain point, it's very hard. I feel that same way too. I'm very much defined by being the child of. We all are, obviously. Yeah. Everybody is a child of somebody, but like some people sort of confront it earlier. Yeah. I'm not afraid to say I'm 49 years old, Emily Cavanagh.
I can't even imagine.
And I'm just now realizing that I'm never going to be any more prepared to be alive than I am right now.
Yeah.
And so, as you say,
well said.
As the adults left the room, you realized, wait, maybe I'm one of them now.
Yeah.
What do I do?
Yeah.
What can I do?
Yeah. And the answer was not learn to cook.
Yeah.
So it was, well, maybe, you know, I can send a song. I can write a song.
Yeah.
I can rally my friends to do this thing that grew a little bit bigger than me that I'd love to continue. But I probably am at a moment, too, where I've learned to ask for help. And so I do know that, like, for it to continue in the times that we're living with all the cuts to nonprofits, with the sustainability factor, I do have to be able to say, I'd love for people to come onto our board. I'd love for fundraisers to join us. I'd love for even, you know, bigger Ronald McDonald houses or like really established NGOs to say like, like we could share the service, you know?
Well, it's sure. I mean, and it's interesting too, because I mean, I've gone through this a little bit recently where I've been starting to look into certain kinds of sponsorship. And what you realize is that sometimes this does not apply to everybody because if somebody's listening and they want to like support you or donate, there are ways to do that. But sometimes you actually have to make sure that your ask is not too small.
Right.
Sometimes it's like the problem is not that we're asking for too much. It's that we're not asking for enough.
So it's funny you say that. I talked to someone the other day and they're like, I think you're thinking too small.
Yeah.
And I was like, really? I feel like I've been thinking kind of big. And they're like, I'm not sure you know what thinking big maybe is.
I mean, I had a conversation recently with somebody also who was like, if you don't ask for enough, it doesn't look like the impact will be large enough.
That's
and
right.
You have to believe that impact will be large enough or help somebody else see that it will be.
Yeah.
Because as we know, there's a lot of money out there.
Right.
And it gets wasted on all kinds of crazy things. And so, it, you know, for you to come out here and ask for some small amount to do this good work, thinking that somehow that's the most appropriate way, you might not only be limiting what you could be getting, but you might also be like, I don't know, cutting off.
Doing a disservice.
Doing a disservice to it.
Totally. Well, maybe it's a little bit like the girl that sold her boyfriend's CDs at her own shows. I think there's like some element of truth that goes through
so
these
maybe
stories.
You should go out and try to sell sponsorship for my program and I'll go out and try to raise money for you.
Actually, there we go. I think we've come up with a good plan.
Well, okay. Well, I will start right now by saying asongforyou.org. What is it?
Okay. Are you been fired?
What is it? Here is a song for you.biz, Emily's initiative.tv,
Danny DeVito.
Danny DeVito's neighbor. I lived next to Danny DeVito. Well, okay.
Grace's roommate.
Where am I sending people?
Okay. So we were born a song for you initiative.
Yeah.
After the Donny Hathaway song.
Okay.
We still are a song for you, but we later realized that a song for you exists as a corporate entity.
Yeah.
And so they have taken.
They took it from you.
They took it from us.
Donny Hathaway's people took it from you.
So we now go by Song for You Foundation. And if you want to check us out at any of the socials, it's just songforyou.org.
Wait, I was pretty close.
You said some version of that.
I said something pretty close, I have to
say. Here's a song for you, biz.
Well, I got to that eventually. Okay. Songforyou.org.
Songforyou.org. You got it.
No, here is.
No.
No, Donny Hathaway.
No. Leo, are we going to make another record?
I was just about to ask you about that whole aspect of your career and your life.
Yeah.
You know, we made one full-length album, and then we made one EP, which is now a while ago. We made the first one upstairs, and then we made the second one in this room.
Yep.
I made those records at a time when I was producing a lot of albums for people, and it was just like a thing that I was doing. And I listened back because we did a gig last year, and I was so... I loved the music, and I loved the second one, too, the one...
The Ireland one.
The Ireland EP, after you had made it big in Ireland and become like a celebrity singer in Ireland.
There must be something about you, darling. Something I can't explain. The way a song in the night gets started. The way a walk in the rain.
You're big in Spain. You get it.
Of course. Everybody's got to have a place that there's no actual proof of.
No one's literally really ever heard of me in Ireland. I just am the support act for all the big stars.
Hey, man, take it. You're bigger than most. Yeah, let's do another one. I think we should do another one.
Maybe we'll get sponsorship for that.
Honestly, it would be interesting to look through the songs that you wrote and start there.
Yeah. It's brought me so much joy to be able to do this, to run this charity and to do this project these last 5 years. I also just know that it's one piece of my story.
And the other thing is, drawing this line in the sand between doing music as service and doing music as self-expression, it's not always that way. Obviously, you can write songs that are very meaningful to people for personal reasons, not because they're sick, but just because they...
It's true. I mean, I've never felt so connected in terms of the work I'm doing as I have these last 5 years, where there is no separation anymore of like, well, I go to this job or I go to the... Right. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's all coming from the same well.
Yes. Emily Kavanaugh, thank you for going to the well with me today.
Leo Sidran. It's been a blast.
There must be something.
There she was, my friends, Emily Kavanaugh. What an infectious, marvelous person. Questionably adulting, moving forward even when her legs give out. I am inspired. I'll be back again before you know it in your headspace with another deep dive. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.